From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What is the Trump administration's ultimate endgame with Iran? Containment? Renegotiation of the nuclear deal? Regime change? Well, those questions need answers as tensions between Washington and Iran ratchet up. Today, Iran announcing that it's within 10 days of breaching limits from the 2015 nuclear deal on non-weapons-grade uranium enrichment. And of course, late last week, the Trump administration quickly blaming Iran for two attacks on tankers in the Gulf of Oman. So this hour on Point, what is the Trump administration's strategy as tensions escalate with Iran? And you can join us. What do you make of those tanker explosions? Is the Trump administration right to point the finger on almost instantly at Iran? Or when you hear members of the international community pushing back and operators of one of the tankers themselves calling the claims into question, do you worry that the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for war? Or is Iran further provoking response when it says it's ramping up uranium enrichment? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start first today in Washington with David Larder, naval warfare reporter for Defense News. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, talk to us a little bit more about what Iran just announced, that it's within a few days of breaching those limits on the 2015 or set by the 2015 Iran nuclear deal on uranium enrichment. What did Iran say specifically?
So what Iran said was, I think that gets largely to the point. What Iran said was that they were going to increase the limits or breach the threshold within the next few days of the limits of enriching uranium. And I guess the point here is that the with uranium, it gets to about 20% enriched, and that's good enough to operate a nuclear reactor. But you can get, but the threshold is getting from, you know, to that 20%. Once you get higher than 20%, you need to get up to about 90% for weapons grade uranium. So that's why it's kind of a big deal. But the jump to 20% is less, difficult than going from 20% to 90%, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's what they're threatening to do. So obviously the world, and the United States and everyone is particularly concerned about them getting that 20% threshold, because getting to weapons grade is a lot simpler from 20% on.
So, and this announcement, even though Iran said it was headed down this path for quite some time, the announcement today that they're within, you know, a couple of days comes right after those recent attacks last week in the Gulf of Oman. I'm wondering if now the members of the international community who are still part of the Iran nuclear agreement, namely, you know, European nations, if they're feeling a sense of urgency to, I don't know, renegotiate with Iran, reset the terms of the agreement, what are members of the international community saying?
So this is an interesting point, and I think what we need to see is where the members of the international community are. Partly, this all kind of fits into a strategy that Iran seems to be executing that drives a wedge between Washington and its traditional European allies. The European allies did not support the Trump administration declaring that the U.S. was not going to abide by the Iran nuclear deal anymore. And they did that for a number of reasons. Partly, I think, inside the administration, they felt that Iran wasn't, the deal was not changing Iran's behavior internationally. It may be abiding by the individual provisions, but it didn't change their behavior. And then there were just the political considerations that anything your predecessor does just can't be as good as anything that you would do. And administration after administration sort of falls prey to this. And because it wasn't ratified by Congress, it's not law. So we didn't have to abide by it. It was just kind of an executive agreement. So all that to say, France and the other major powers, they didn't agree with us pulling out of the U.S. pulling out of that agreement. So Iran seems to be putting pressure on Europe to say, hey, we're having this issue with Washington. Get your friend in line. Or maybe just break the European allies off altogether over this issue to try and get them into Iran's corner to oppose Washington. And I think Iran is operating not with, you know, they don't have a super strong hand to play against the United States. They don't pose an overwhelming military threat, and they're suffering under the ongoing economic sanctions. So trying to break up the alliance structure between the U.S. and traditional European allies makes a certain degree of sense.
Interesting. Okay, so given that context, let's talk more, David, about what happened late last week with those two attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Of course, last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo very quickly saying that it was the assessment, quote, of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran was responsible for the attacks. Here is what the Secretary of State said on Sunday on Fox News, doubling down on that assessment.
It's unmistakable what happened here. These were attacks by the Islamic Republic of Iran on commercial shipping on the freedom of navigation with a clear intent to deny transit through the strait. This was on the Gulf of Oman side of the Strait of Hormuz. There's no doubt. The intelligence community has lots of data, lots of evidence. The world will come to see much of it, but the American people should rest assured we have high confidence with respect to who conducted these attacks, as well as a half a dozen other attacks throughout the world.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just yesterday on Fox News. But David Larder, has the Trump administration presented any of this additional evidence that the secretary is talking about?
So we're well into finger pointing land at the moment. The Trump administration, I think, so one of the reasons why this all makes people very uncomfortable is because we haven't seen a lot of the evidence. We've seen a surveillance video of some people in a boat. Looks like they're removing a mine, or it could be a what the Navy terms a mine-like object. And that seems to be the most compelling evidence, but how we know who those people in the boat are, or what in fact they're actually doing, we don't really know that. And obviously the reason this makes everyone uncomfortable is because the run-up to the Iraq War, we were told one thing about weapons of mass destruction, and it turns out, for any number of reasons that I don't think is helpful to relitigate on this program, that turned out to not be the case, at least not right now anyway. I think the point to be made here is that the U.S. government saying intelligence says X is not the bar anymore. It's not necessarily what the populace of our country or the U.K. or any of our European allies will accept. They do need to present more of what they have if there's going to be any action taken beyond just the sort of war of words that we're at right now.
David, your point taken about not relitigating the Iraq war, but it absolutely, as you mentioned, is part of the context here about how not just in the United States, but the international community is reacting to the Trump administration's claims. I mean, in addition to that, we have, let's be honest, doubts in the international community and even here in the United States about the veracity of a lot of things that come from the Trump administration due to the president's own sort of casual relationship with the truth. And we also have the Japanese operators of one of the tankers that was attacked saying, no, we don't think it was a mine, one of those limpet mines. It might have been a bullet or something flying through the water. Can you tell us more about that?
Right. And I read that over the weekend, and that certainly is a wrinkle. You would think that the operator would have spoken to his crew and gotten their best assessment. And so I guess to the larger point here is that we still don't really know, and there's a lot of confusion. And if there's a conclusion to be drawn, I don't want to say that I can't sit here and say, because I don't have any information one way or the other, to say that Mike Pompeo and the intelligence community assessment is wrong or that they're being dishonest. But just that it may have been a little hasty to come out the day after or within a few, 24 hours to say, oh, it's our assessment that we did this. It would have been more helpful, I think, to put your case together and lay it out. I mean, I'm reminded of I don't want to make a broad comparison to an episode of Such Consequence, but if you'll remember during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Kennedy administration, when they wanted to accuse Russia of putting the nuclear missiles in Cuba, they put their case together, they got the intelligence together, and they presented it at the United Nations. It was quick, but they had a thorough argument, right? So that may have been not fully thought out, because what I heard when I heard Mike Pompeo talk was is the assessment of the U.S. government, and even in the clip you just played, he was basically referencing Americans can rest assured. Well, again, to the original point, I don't know that the American public or our allies are in a place to take assurances from U.S. government officials without a lot of evidence laid out. So I think that's just the nature of our post-Iraq war world, where we're just a little more skeptical of what the intelligence community says. We really need to see it.
Well, David Larder is naval warfare reporter for Defense News, speaking to us from Washington. David, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Trita Parsi, joining us from Washington. Trita is founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council and adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies. His latest book is Losing an Enemy: Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's been several days now since Mike Pompeo's first assertion that Iran was behind these tanker attacks. Do you believe him or do you remain skeptical?
I remain skeptical because, as your previous guest mentioned, we have not seen the evidence. And if I could just make one small correction to the excellent points that he was making, Pompeo never claimed that this was an intelligence assessment. He said that this was a government assessment. There's a significant difference between the two.
Well, he said, he said in this, just to be clear, he said, it is the assessment of the United States government, right, that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks. And then he says, this assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used
Correct.
And the level of expertise needed.
But a government assessment is very different from an intelligence finding. Intelligence findings come with several different degrees of confidence, and it's following certain standards. A government assessment is essentially just his opinion. For him to then say that that opinion is based on intelligence is still not following the same standards. So he's playing with words to, I fear, confuse and be a bit deceptive towards the American people here.
Well, Trita Parsi, we just have to take a quick 60-second break, so stand by for just a moment. We are talking about ever-increasing tensions between Washington and Tehran and what the Trump administration's real endgame is here. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about escalating tensions between Washington and Tehran, especially in the wake of those two tanker attacks in the Gulf of Oman just late last week. We've got comments coming in here online. Jason Turner on our website, onpointradio.org, says, for countries like Russia and China, a nice new American intervention in the Middle East is just fine. It will lead to social rifts in America. It will lead to the U.S. wasting away even more of its treasure on a geopolitically questionable conflict. And someone calling themselves North of the Border says, it's times like these when presidential trustworthiness is most crucial. So now what? Well, let's listen to what the president himself said on Friday morning, the day after those oil tankers were attacked in the Gulf of Oman. President Trump was on Fox and Friends to discuss the attack and Iran's alleged role in it. He cited that video that was released by the government claiming to show members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard removing an unexploded mine from the side of one of the tankers.
Well, Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it. And you saw the boat at night trying to take the mine off and successfully took the mine off the boat.
Yep.
And that was exposed, and that was their boat, that was them. And they didn't want the evidence left behind. I guess they don't know that we have things that we can detect in the dark that work very well.
President Donald Trump on Friday on Fox and Friends, just the day before on Iranian state television, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei described in a meeting with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe he responded to the language from the U.S. government. And here's Khamenei speaking through an interpreter.
I have no response to Trump's message. I tell you some words, but I'm not giving him any message because I don't consider him worthy of even exchanging messages.
That's Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And joining us now, joining us from Washington is Trita Parsi, founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council and adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies. So, Trita Parsi, before the break, you were talking about reasons why you remain skeptical about the U.S. government's claim. I mean, is it just based on what they haven't shown so far or the idea that it's an opinion? What if further evidence were to come out?
Well, if further evidence comes out and one can actually draw the conclusion that what they're saying is correct, and that's, of course, a different situation. But we have to keep in mind that we're talking about an administration, as you yourself put it, that has a very contentious relationship with the truth. But you also have key individuals in this administration, such as John Bolton, who played a key role in lying the United States into a war with Iraq. He has been advocating war with Iran for more than 20 years. And this seems to be his best chance yet to actually actualize that dream of a war with Iran. So mindful of the very clear intent of the administration, or at least certain individuals, important individuals in the administration towards war, I think it is quite important to have a healthy degree of skepticism until further evidence is actually presented. Taking anyone's word at face value at this point, I think, would be a mistake, whether it would be to say that Iran is innocent or to say that Iran is guilty. I think we need to have evidence because this literally is a matter of war and peace.
Hmm. And so then tell us more, give us your insight on the timing of Iran's announcement today, that it's within that 10-day window of superseding the limits on uranium enrichment imposed on Iran by the 2015 nuclear agreement. I mean, is this simply Iran's making this announcement because they are within 10 days of it, or is it an additional provocation? Give us the view of why they said this today.
I'm afraid that, unfortunately, they probably are about 10 days. This is a very unfortunate situation. This is exactly what we should not want them to do. But unfortunately, it's also a very predictable thing that they would do, mindful of the fact that the Trump administration violated the deal a year ago, walked out of it, has been punishing countries for abiding by it. The United States is essentially in violation of a UN Security Council resolution on the nuclear deal. So it is completely unrealistic to expect that the United States can leave the deal, violate the deal, punish countries that are adhering to the deal, and then that on top of that, the Iranians would remain inside the deal. At some point, it was clear that they would leave, and that's a very, very bad thing. But this brings us back to the larger point. This is a fabricated crisis. This is completely unnecessary. This was a resolved issue. Donald Trump came in and through pressure from the Saudis and the Israelis and others and unresolved this conflict. And here we are now, almost on the brink of war. For what? This deal was working. The Iranians were adhering to it. The entire world was in support of it, with the exception of three countries. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency that is refereeing the deal, had now issued 15 reports saying the Iranians are living up to the deal. So we should not be here in the first place. If Donald Trump had not withdrawn from this deal, we would not be facing this crisis now.
Well, as we mentioned a little earlier, members of the international community, notably Germany and Japan, are distancing themselves from the Trump administration's accusations against Iran, saying that they need more evidence about surrounding the attacks. On the other hand, though, Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt was less skeptical. Here he is speaking to BBC's Radio 4 on Friday.
We have no reason not to believe the American assessment, and our instinct is to believe it because they're our closest ally. And we are very worried about the situation in Iran because at the moment, both sides in this dispute think that the other side doesn't want war, and the risk you have is that then they do something provocative that leads to catastrophic consequences that weren't intended.
Trita Parsi, is the foreign secretary there, is his assessment the right one, that both sides, the U.S. and Iran, presume that the other doesn't want war, so therefore they may be pushing so hard based on that presumption that they could tip over into war?
Well, first of all, I think it was really interesting how he opened it up. He said it's our instinct to believe the Americans. he didn't say that he believed it because he had seen any assessments or any real intelligence findings. And keep in mind that it was also Britain in Europe back in 2003 that supported the United States mistakenly when it came to the Iraq War. So this per se is not terribly surprising. On the point that both sides assume that the other one doesn't want war, I'm not so sure if that's the reality. I think the Iranians do believe that at least some elements in the Trump administration do want war. But nevertheless, I think they appear to have reached a point in which they're thinking that the current situation is only weakening them. The United States is paying no cost for violating the nuclear deal and is only amassing more leverage against Iran and eventually will attack anyway, potentially. And as a result, it lies in their interest to now start threatening the Europeans and saying, if you don't offer us the economic incentives that you promised, that you're obligated to offer as a result of the nuclear deal within 10 days, the Iranians are going to start breaching some of the limits on the uranium enrichment that they can have. It's interesting, though, that they say that this is reversible, which it is, that they will go back to inside the deal as soon as the Europeans live up to the deal. And I think that signals that they're ultimately not looking for actually leaving the deal. They're looking to essentially ensure that the Europeans offer them what they were promised in order for the deal to be able to have some viability inside of Iran.
I see. Well, let's go to a caller really quickly. Let's go to Dolores, who's calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, you're on the air.
Hi, Megan. I'm not a Middle East expert, but there is just far too much controversy, and I think everything here is subject to scrutiny. My understanding is that at the urging of Israel, the United States pulled out of the JCPOA. You have Kushner's relationship with MBS, and MBS has his own agenda. The Saudis are certainly not trustworthy. You have Bolton, who thinks, you know, bomb everybody and anybody who's not in lockstep with the United States. You have Pompeo, who has long been opposed to the JCPOA. So I think, you know, there's a huge power struggle going on here, and the United States is being sucked into something that, you know, we really shouldn't get into. And I don't understand, why would Iran bomb a Japanese tanker when President Shinzo Abe is in Tehran? I mean, this is not the first time the United States would stick it to Iran. They did it in the 50s when, you know, there was the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh that, you know, resulted in his assassination and, you know, the rest is history.
Right. Well, Dolores, thank you so much for your call. Lots of interesting questions there. We'll try to take them one by one. But in order to do that, let me introduce into the conversation Ruel Marc Gerecht, joins us from Washington. He's a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, former director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for the New American Century, and Middle East specialist at the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Ruel Marc Gerecht, welcome back to On Point.
Pleasure, Magna.
So first of all, respond to Dolores's sort of bigger question about, she's concerned that the United States is being sucked into a potential conflict with Iran, given the competing interests within the region itself. You mentioned Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia.
I disagree with that. I mean, I don't think the United States is being sucked into anything. I think the Trump administration came in and quite correctly determined that the JCPOA makes Swiss cheese look solid, and they took issue with it, and they walked away from it. It was not a treaty. President Obama could have submitted that and made the argument before the U.S. Senate. He chose not to. It was an executive agreement, and the president withdrew from it, which is he was entitled to. The United States often walks away from executive agreements. So inevitably, because Iran got so much out of the JCPOA, it was going to be quite cranky when it was revoked by the United States. And the administration has taken what I would describe sort of as a light containment approach to the clerical regime. It is using sanctions quite aggressively, much more effectively than many people thought. Yet it is quite restrained on the ground. It has not taken issue really with Iranian imperialism in Mesopotamia or the Levant, minus the few hundred soldiers which are sort of blocking their land route in Syria. So I would expect the administration to maintain its present approach. I don't think it's going to be detoured. There is, I would certainly disagree with Treat. I've discussed Treat on many things, but there certainly is a chance that the clerical regime will, in fact, approach the administration probably secretly at first to try to restart some type of talks. That could be derailed if we do have a military conflict in the Persian Gulf. And I do think that the U.S. Navy eventually will have to take issue with the Revolutionary Guard Corps units that put down these mines, because we are the guarantor of free navigation in the Persian Gulf.
Trita Parsi, would you like to respond to that?
Well, first to the point that the caller made, yes, MBS has said that he has Jared Kushner in his pocket. Bibi Netanyahu himself was bragging that he's the one who managed to get Trump to leave the agreement. So with statements of that kind coming out of them, and their interest in this is very, very clear. They were opposed to the nuclear deal not because of any particular details of the deal, but rather because an agreement with Iran on this issue would reduce the U.S.'s involvement against Iran. It would resolve some of the tensions between the U.S. and Iran, but not all of them. But it would actually allow the United States to not be so bogged down in the Middle East and be able to focus on other things, whether it's crisis in Asia or things at home. And they don't want that. They want the United States to have a strong military dominance in the region and essentially protect them, or protect their maneuverability and their very beneficial position geopolitically in the region. So any agreement that actually would allow the United States to slowly but surely escape itself out of the Middle East is something that they would be in disagreement with. And a crisis of this kind that brings the United States back into military conflict in the region or on the brink of it is exactly what helps them be able to achieve their objective of having American hegemony in the Middle East, which they will then live under the protection of. So the motivation of those countries, I don't think, really is under question, and their influence over the Trump administration seems to be quite significant. As to the issue that Ruhl raised about the nuclear deal and saying that the Iranians are cranky because they got so much out of it, frankly, the Iranians have gotten almost nothing out of it. It's surprising to a lot of observers that the Iranians remained in the deal for a full year, even though they actually got none of the benefits. And part of the reason I think right now that they're not particularly deterred by European threats that they would start sanctioning Iran is because those sanctions are completely irrelevant. The Europeans are right now adhering to the American sanctions, very angrily, of course, and grudgingly. But as long as they're adhering to the American sanctions, there essentially is no reasonable trade between the U.S., between Iran and the EU. And as a result, the Europeans have lost their leverage. They've already stopped buying Iranian oil. Hmm. They've closed down the airports for Iranian airplanes, etc. So the Trump administration has taken away any leverage the Europeans had. The only leverage they actually have remaining is if they start essentially standing up for their own independence and agree to adhere to the obligations they have under the deal, in which they would be trading with Iran and keeping that deal alive. That would put them in yet another conflict with the Trump administration. Mm. You know, there's plenty of tensions between the Europeans and the U.S. right now, from everything, the Paris Agreement that the Trump administration withdrew from to other matters.
Yeah, so,
and I think that's part of the thing that they're afraid of. They just don't want to have a conflict with the United States.
So, Ruel, let me turn back to you here for a second, because everything that both of you said, we could parse through them in extreme detail. But I did want to ask you that we had you on the show, you know, a couple of months ago when tensions started to build in the Gulf of Oman. And then you had said that you were pretty sanguine about the U.S. and Iran not tipping into military conflict. But here now, if I heard you correctly, you just said that you do believe that the United States Navy may eventually have to intercede or take care of business with the Revolutionary Guard in the region here. So has your position changed on that? Has the posture from Washington become more bellicose that you're now are you saying that military conflict is a little more likely?
Well, I don't think the United States has become more bellicose. I do think the Islamic Republic has become a tad bit more stupid. I mean, I do think the clerical regime has no desire whatsoever to have a straight-on conflict with the United States. They know that would be suicidal. So they attack on the periphery. They engage in mining operations in the Persian Gulf. They try to conduct terrorism in Europe. You know, they tried to blow up a meeting of dissident group in Paris. It was thwarted by French internal security. It's a way of, you know, punishing the Europeans for being a doormat for the United States. So, they try to strike around the periphery. They try to deny responsibility, hoping the United States won't hit them. At the same time, they try to spook the Europeans, spook the Japanese. So some, they'll engage in some pressure tactics against the United States. I don't think it will work. However, it must be said that if they mine the Persian Gulf, the U.S. Navy will respond to that. We are the guarantor of free navigation. So if they act in such a stupid manner, then they can expect a response.
Well, Ruel, Mark Garecht, and Trita Parsi, stand by. We are talking about ever-increasing tensions between Washington and Tehran and what the end game is or should be here. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about Washington and Tehran and increasing tensions between the United States and Iran. Trita Parsi joins us today. He's founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council and an adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies. Ruel Mark Garecht is also with us. He's senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Let's listen to a little bit of what Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said about rising U.S.-Iranian tensions. She was on CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS on Sunday.
We have absolutely no appetite for going to war or to be provocative to create situations that might evoke responses where mistakes could be made. You know, it's one, countries exercise their leverage, they threaten, they this or that, but there could be mistakes made, and that's a very dangerous thing.
Nancy Pelosi there on Sunday. Alex is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is in regards to Saudi Arabia's possible role in the alleged attacks in the Gulf of Oman. I think it's important to remember that we have an ongoing conflict in Yemen with Iran and Saudi Arabia engaging as proxies. And Saudi Arabia definitely stands to benefit from any kind of U.S. engagement with Iran. And I just wondered what this panel's thoughts on that were.
Alex, thank you for your call. Ruel, Mark Garecht, let me start with you on that. Your response to Alex.
Well, I mean, as a general rule, I try not to go down a conspiratorial wormhole. I don't think the notion that the Saudis are taking speedboats that look like the Revolutionary Guard Corps speedboats and are traveling around the Persian Gulf and blowing up tankers is credible. I don't know of anyone in the U.S. Navy who believes that. I don't know of anyone in the French or British admiralties who believes that. So I don't think that's likely. Now, it is certainly true that the Saudis would like to see the United States take a harder line against the Islamic Republic. They were certainly upset by President Obama's attempt to withdraw from the region and to use the nuclear deal as sort of as a decent interval for our retreat. But it's just not credible to suggest the Saudis are behind this.
So, point taken about perhaps it's not credible to suggest the Saudis are behind this to the degree that you mentioned, but about Saudi credibility as a whole. I mean, this is a government, or at least through Mohammed bin Salman, who you know, they hacked to death a journalist in one of their consulates in Turkey, then lied about it multiple times until they were forced to, you know, not fully admit it. But the truth eventually came out. So Saudi credibility isn't, you know, isn't perfect right now in the eyes of the international community.
No, I mean, the Saudis, the particularly Crown Prince Salman, is obviously a very rash young man, and he has been proven to lie. But again, you know, the Iranian regime has aided and abetted the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in Syria. Yet I defy you to find a statement by either Foreign Minister Zarif or President Rouhani where they own up to that bloodshed.
Trita Parsi, respond to that.
Well, in regards to the Saudis potentially being behind us, of course, it is as speculative as saying that it's the Iranians mindful that we don't have any evidence. That video actually doesn't show anything. We don't even know if it's a mine that is being removed. But perhaps more importantly, as you pointed out in the program earlier on, the ship, according to the people on the ship, were not attacked by mines. They were attacked by something from air. So the premise of Mark's argument that the Saudis would not be pretending to be IRGC folks on a boat is premised on the idea that the boat we saw was the IRGC and that was the Iranians, and that the video has any validity in this. And we don't know that yet. But we do know this. We know that the former Secretary of Defense of the United States, Bob Gates, told the French defense minister in 2010 that the Saudis are trying to fight the Iranians to the last American, that they were doing everything they could to push the United States into war with Iran, a war that they themselves cannot fight, so they want the United States to fight it for them. They want young American men and women to die for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. We do know that as a fact. And given that, we have to be extra cautious about all of these different things that the administration is putting out right now. We need to see solid evidence, because we may be going into a war that has nothing to do with defending America and everything to do to defend some dictators in the Middle East.
So, Ruel, let me turn back to you on this, because, you know, a lot of focus is put on John Bolton, for example, and his years-long, as Trita Parsi pointed out, years-long call for regime change in Iran. But shouldn't we also be focusing on the fact that one of the loudest and most prominent voices in this moment, and rightly so, as Secretary of State of the United States of America, is Mike Pompeo, whom himself, back in 2014, before even the Iranian nuclear deal was put into place, he called off for breaking off talks with Iran and instead launching airstrikes against Iranian nuclear facilities. I mean, he too has been very hawkish on Iran well before he became a cabinet member of the Trump administration here. So tell us, what evidence do you see, Ruel, that influential members of the Trump administration aren't seeking anything other than regime change in Iran?
Well, I suspect that John Bolton, I mean, John Bolton is usually true to his word. I think John Bolton is still seeking regime change in Iran. And I believe that Michael Pompeo, if he could choose, would probably go in that direction, too. They just don't use the phrase regime change. Now, the president of the United States, I don't think is on the same page there. I think he really does believe in his powers of negotiation and would like to have a different nuclear deal. What the dimensions of that nuclear deal would be, I don't know. But, I mean, I have to compliment both Bolton and Pompeo, since they, together with the author of the 12-point speech that Pompeo gave in May, which essentially got rid of the notion that you can have any type of nuclear deal without looking at Iran's regional behavior. I mean, that is essentially reverting to the argument that George Shultz made with the Soviets, and I think it was the correct one, that you cannot separate these things. They have to come together. Now, you know, where this is going to go, I don't know. But I know that what the administration has done is they have deprived the Iranian regime of billions of dollars of hard currency. And I think that was a very commendable approach.
So, Trita Parsi, there are some who are saying or wondering, some analysts that I've been reading who are saying, because of what Ruel Marcgrecht just pointed out about the deprivation of cash and also the sanctions on Iran more broadly, that if, again, I underscore a big if indeed Iran is responsible for these recent attacks in the Gulf of Oman, that it's Tehran's way of saying, well, 20% of the oil that the world relies on passes through the Strait of Hormuz, so we too can exercise a little bit of pain on the international community. Any legitimacy to that?
Certainly, and the Iranians have actually explicitly said that if they can't sell their oil, no one else can. So there's clearly motives that the Iranians can have, reasonable motives, that would point the finger to Iran as being the culprit. But motives is not the same thing as conclusive evidence. And Iran is not the only one with motive. We just talked about Saudi Arabia, who does have a motive and an interest in fabricating something that would cause the United States and Iran to go to war with each other. But that's also not evidence. So what we need to do in this situation, in order to avoid walking into yet another endless war in the Middle East that will destroy not only that region, it will spread extremism in the region, exactly as the Iraq war did. We saw the emergence of ISIS as a direct consequence of the invasion of Iraq, but also all the problems that it causes the United States at home. In order to avoid that, we need to really take a step back and make sure that we actually have proper evidence. But on the idea that the Iranians want to inflict some pain on the international community for them not getting their economic benefits from the nuclear deal, I think that is a fair assessment of what the Iranians are thinking and probably doing something. But I think they're doing that by making these threats about breaching some of the limits on the nuclear program, because that is reversible. That has more of an upside for them, very little of that downside. And as their own statement said, once the Europeans are back in compliance with the deal, the Iranians will go back into compliance as well. So it seems to me that if that's what they want to do, that's the better way for them to be able to protest and use some leverage against the Europeans, rather than actually attacking a Japanese tanker at the very same moment that the supreme leader of Iran is actually sitting in a meeting with the Japanese prime minister. It just sounds a little bit too weird.
Mm. Let's go to Brenda, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say, first of all, I think that the Trump administration and the GOP are itching to go to war before an election. The GOP, the Republicans, always argue, oh, we're in a war, we can't change administrations at this point. I don't believe a whole lot that comes out of this administration. I think there's a lot of warmongering going on. But I want to know about Congress. Mm. How much does Congress have an input into this?
Well, Brenda, thank you for your call. Ruel Marcgrecht, would you like to answer, Brenda?
Well, one, I don't think the Trump administration is particularly bellicose, just the opposite of that, actually. I think the president sometimes sounds like Obama 2.0 when he talks about the Middle East. What is surprising is that on this issue, he actually goes in the other direction. So I'm skeptical. Now, and also I have to say the GOP in general, I mean, one of the great mistakes that President Obama made with the JCPOA is that he failed to actually take it to the Senate. I think the strategy that Ben Rhodes worked out, which was essentially screaming Iraq, Vietnam at every single moment, sort of like what Trita does, might have been successful in the Senate. And he might have spooked Republicans to actually agree to that to the deal, even though it was a very bad deal. I don't think that's true now. I don't think the Republicans have any desire, the congressional Republicans, to have another war in the Middle East. Though I do think there is a consensus inside of the Republican Party that the JCPOA is simply unacceptable.
So, Ruel, let me just ask you a quick question here, which I should just have asked this plainly to begin with. Do you think the United States should engage in military action against Iran?
Well, I think if the Iranians are putting down mines in the Persian Gulf, the U.S. Navy has to respond to that. Without a shadow of a doubt.
Meaning what, though? What would the response be?
Oh, you take helicopter gunships and you eliminate those IRGC naval vessels that have been training for decades to deploy mines. And by the way, they also use high-velocity, low-caliber cannons to attack shipping. So I would go after them to make it crystal clear that any type of action like that will incur a rapid and severe response. I think, in retrospect, the administration made a mistake when they had the tankers, the ships attacked off of Fujairah, that they didn't then engage in a military operation against the IRGC.
And what confidence do we have that that wouldn't escalate then into a much larger military conflict?
Because I don't – well, it's possible. I don't think – I think history tells us with the Islamic Republic, they don't want to go there. So, you know, when the Ronald Reagan decided to destroy most of the surface fleet of the Iranian Navy in 1988 after it had put mines down that struck a U.S. vessel, they did not escalate. In fact, it was a contributing factor to the Iranians giving up in the Iran-Iraq war.
Trita Parsi, do you want to respond to that? Because I imagine many Americans are saying, how can the United States government have any sort of confidence of containing the reaction or response or consequences of escalated military action in the Middle East, given the Iraq war?
Well, this is how you actually sell a big war. You pretend that you're just selling a small war because people know that the American public is not in the doesn't have the appetite for a big war. So you just present it as, look, we're just going to strike them a little bit here and then mention something that happened in 1986. Well, 1986, the Iranians were 6 years into the war with Iraq. The Iraqis had been using chemical weapons against Iran for several years with the blessing of the United States. So the Iranians were in a much weaker situation. I think it's quite instructive to just see what happened about 3 or 4 weeks ago when Trump, who Ruel says is not bellicose, tweeted that he would put an official end to Iran and moved some warships to the Persian Gulf. Then we saw that the Iranians were starting to put missiles on ships. Bolton took this as evidence that the Iranians were preparing an attack on the U.S. to Trump. But it seems like he actually spooked Trump a little bit because Trump had been led to believe that Iran is like Syria. You can just strike with a couple of Tomahawk missiles and it won't do anything in return. Whereas in reality, the Iranians were actually preparing to fight back and defend themselves if they were attacked, which then directly means it is not going to be a small war. If there is any form of attack, the likelihood that it will escalate into a very, very big war, much bigger than what the Iraq war is quite significant. And that's, again, why we have to not only take a step back and be very clear about what the evidence is, but we also have to treat those who lured us into the Iraq war in the first place, such as John Bolton. We have to take everything they say and any administration they serve in with a tremendous amount of salt.
Well, Ruel, Mark Grech, we have a minute left to go here. You were in strong support of the Iraq war in the early days. I mean, respond to what Trita Parsi says. What has your opinion on the U.S.'s ability to control the dynamic in the region changed at all since then?
Well, I think that if you're going to engage in containment, if you're going to guarantee freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf, you may have to use military force. I mean, this is 101. This is not something that's terribly complicated. Now, you can run from that. You can decline to serve that role in the region, and I think you will regret it quite quickly. But if the United States is going to guarantee freedom of navigation, if it's going to guarantee the free movement of oil through the Persian Gulf, you may have to use force. If the Islamic Republic is willing to use force and you are not, then they win, you lose.
Well, Ruel Mark Grech, Senior Fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Trita Parsi, founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council, adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Folks, go to onpointradio.org and let us know what you think about what's happening in the Gulf of Oman. Again, it's onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.